We sang, didn't we? Strength for today, bright hope for tomorrow. And I think this passage gives us that. When you're given a three topic as a preacher, it's always hard. I'm so used to be given a passage and you kind of, your mind darts around this, that or the other. And these verses came to mind and they do offer us strength for today and bright hope for the future. Mel Blanc is a person you'll know of. You'll certainly have heard his voice. He's called the voice of the man of a thousand voices. If you've ever seen Woody Woodpecker, Bugs Bunny, Porky Pig, Daffy Duck, Sylvester, Tweety Pie, all these characters, Mel Blanc is the voice behind them. And even if you can't remember the cartoons, you'll remember his catchphrase, which is, "That's all, folks." And he did the voice for that. And on his gravestone, they put those words. Just under the Star of David, because Mel Blanc was Jewish, they put those words, "That's all, folks. That's all." For these two disciples, as they walked down that road to Emmaus, they could have said to each other, "That's all, folks. We had hoped. We put all of our eggs in one basket. We put all of our trust in Jesus. That's all, folks. When he hung on a cross, that's the end. Left to die." Easter is a message that there is more. There is more. "That's all, folks" has been crossed out. There is more. And as we come to this passage, I want to put it under a number of headings. First of all, broken hearts. That's verses 13 to 14. Now, at the same day, two of them were going to a village called Emmaus, about 7 miles from Jerusalem. They were talking with each other about everything that had happened. I think some of the saddest words in our language all start with the letter D. Disappointment, doubt, disillusionment, discouragement, despondency, depression, despair, death. And all those words kind of sum up how Cleopas and his friend were feeling as they made that journey on that road to Emmaus. This little section begins with the words, "That same day." He's referring to the events mentioned in verse 1, the first day of the week, Sunday, what we would call Easter Sunday. It should have been a time of celebration, but these two had missed out. And for them, it was no hope, no bright future, no strength. It was all negative. Who was with Cleopas? Well, your guess is as good as mine. You can pick up the commentaries and the experts will tell you it could have been this and it could have been that. And maybe it was so. Nobody knows. Nobody knows. The fact they go back to Cleopas' house may suggest the other companion was his brother or his wife or a relative of some kind. But nobody knows. The two disciples were hurting. Their hearts were broken. "We had hoped." Ever feel let down? Ever feel disappointed? Well, all of those D words bring those kind of experiences. "That's all, folks." For them it was at this particular moment. So to go from broken hearts, and I'm going to use a bit of alliteration because I'm a preacher. Blinkered hearts. Blinkered hearts. Look at verse 15. "As they talked and discussed these things with each other, Jesus himself came up and walked along with them. But they were kept from recognizing him." It was as if blinkers were over their eyes. They could not see who he was. They stood still, their faces downcast. One of them, named Cleopas, asked him, "Are you the only one visiting Jerusalem who does not know the things that have happened there in these days?" "What things?" they asked. "About Jesus of Nazareth," they replied. "He was a prophet, powerful in word and deed before God and all the people. The chief priests and our rulers handed him over to be sentenced to death, and they crucified him. But we had hoped that he was the one who was going to redeem Israel. And what is more, it is the third day since all this took place. In addition, some of our women amazed us. They went to the tomb early in the morning, but didn't find his body. They came and told us they had seen a vision of angels who said he was alive. Then some of our companions went to the tomb and found it just as the woman had said, but they did not see Jesus. He said to them, "How foolish you are, how slow to believe all the prophets have spoken. Did not the Messiah have to suffer these things and then enter his glory?" I mentioned the fact I visit nursing homes and take services in them, and one of my favourite stories has to do with a nursing home. And there was a group of elderly people, senior citizens, who were sitting around having a cup of coffee together and chatting. And one of them said, "You know, my cataracts are so bad, I can hardly see that cup of coffee on that table." And another one said, well, "My hand's so shaky, I can hardly pick it up without spilling that cup of coffee from the table." The other one said, "Well, my blood pressure is so dizzy that, again, I'm not sure if the cup of coffee can help me if I picked it up and downed it." And the other person said, "Well, I can't move my neck round to see the coffee on the table because it's kind of stiff." And they looked at each other and said, "I guess that's the price we pay for getting old." And they all nodded. And then one man said, "Well, look on the bright side. At least we can still drive." These two disciples had not lost their sight because of deterioration, because of old age. You know, my wife and my kids are telling me, "Dad, get some glasses." And I say, "No, I can see it. I don't need them. Just give me a magnifying glass." And we deteriorate. But it wasn't because of lack of vision they couldn't see. Something supernatural is going on here. Did Jesus look any different after his resurrection than before? Well, we're not entirely sure. But what we do is, wherever he turned up, people recognised him. So maybe not. He certainly had a glorified body. But everyone seemed to know who he was. This is supernatural. Withholding their knowledge, their eyesight, so they can't understand fully who this individual is who has joined them on the road to Emmaus. And like I say, verse 21 are some of the saddest verses in the gospel. We had hoped. Feel the disillusionment in those words. We didn't expect it. We once did. We had high hopes for the future. But all those hopes have evaporated. All we have now is disappointment. I guess all of us at times can identify with the feelings of these two disciples. When you experience disappointment, doubt, disillusionment, defeat, discouragement, depression, despondency, despair, and especially death, it does break our hearts. It does sadden our hearts. God can seem distant, out of sight. I love the way Jesus responds to these two. He didn't say, "Come on, snap out of it. Man up, get your act together." He simply provides a listening ear. You probably know the story of the little girl whose friend had died, and she said to her mum, "Mum, I've got to go and see my friend's mummy." And the little girl's mum said, "Well, it's probably not a good time and it's probably not a good idea. Just leave it for a while." And she said, "No, I've got to go. I need to go." And she kept pestering her mum. So her mum made a quick telephone call saying, "Look, you know our daughters were friends. She wants to come round and see you. Is that okay?" And the grieving mum said, "No problem. You bring her round." And so she dropped her off. She waited, and about half an hour later, she came back to collect a little girl who came bouncing out the door, as little girls do, got in the car. And the mum, curious, said, "What did you say to your friend's mum?" And the girl said, "Oh, I didn't say anything. I just gave her a hug and we cried." Sometimes words are not enough, are they? And sometimes all we have to do is be a listening ear, to grieve with those who grieve, to mourn with those who mourn. And Jesus listens to the heartbreak of these disciples as they tell their story. "We had hoped. All our dreams have evaporated." And he then reassures them. He does that patiently. He listens first. And then he reminds them what God says in the Bible. He challenges them. "Okay, come on. Now it's time to see if you believe what you believe. Is it just theology in your head? Or is it a faith that is living and active?" He said, "How foolish you are, slow to believe, all the prophets have spoken. And then we go into our third one, bruised hearts, verse 27. And beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he explained to them what was said in all the scriptures concerning himself. He gives them a briefing, he gives them information. He gives them that which they needed to hear. I think had Jesus drew alongside them and said, "Hi, it's me, remember?" I think they wouldn't have heard a single word Jesus said after that. They would have been so awestruck by the very presence. They had the living Christ with them. His words would have gone, well, over their heads. And then when Jesus disappeared, as he did, a few hours later, they'd have said, "It was him. What? Oh, I don't know what he said. I thought you were listening." They wouldn't have had a clue. They would have just been in a useless situation again. So Jesus gives them some anchors for the soul, some promises to hold on to. He takes them to the Word, because when he's gone, they're going to experience them afresh through the Word from now on. And so he prepares them and he gets them ready so that when Jesus goes, they've still got the Word. They've still got those anchors for the soul. So he lets them discover him in the Scriptures. I love verse 27. When Jesus must have given the best ever Old Testament Bible study, he reminded them everything that should have happened. Verse 27. In your English Bible, and the Bible used in the Christian world, the Bible, of course, is in two halves, Old Testament and New Testament. If you were Jewish, all you had was the Old Testament, the part of the Bible before Jesus came to planet Earth. And a Jewish Bible is not divided into two parts, but three parts. They divide their Old Testament into what they call the Torah, the Nabin, and the Hetavim. The Torah is the first five books. They're the most important parts of the Bible if you are Jewish. The Nabin is the prophets, except for Daniel. For some reason, they put him elsewhere. And the book of Judges and 1 and 2 Kings. And then the third part of a Jewish Bible is called the Hetavim, which are the historical books plus Daniel. That's how a Jew knows their Bible, those three sections. These two men were Jewish. Jesus was Jewish. The Old Testament are Jewish scriptures. And so he speaks to them in their own cultural way, their own language. He talks about the law of Moses. That is the Torah, the first five books. He mentions the prophets. That's the Nevi'im, the second part of a Jewish Bible. And then he talks about the Psalms, the Hetavim, the third part of the Jewish Bible. He's basically saying, look, guys, wherever you look in your Bible, from there to there, it speaks of me. If you don't believe me, let me show you. He takes them through the scriptures. Don't know how long his sermon was. You know, I preach and people get a cup of tea afterwards to wake them up. Jesus preached. I don't think anyone was watching the clock. They were just captivated. They were seeing him afresh in the scriptures. Now, here's a challenge for you. If you only had your Old Testament, could you prove to an unchristian who Jesus was?
Yes.
Good for you. Can anyone else? Can you explain his death, his resurrection, how someone gets right with God if you've just got your Old Testament? Fourthly, burning hearts. Verses 28 to 32. As they approached the village to which they were going, Jesus continued on as if he were going further. But they urged him strongly, "Stay with us, for it is nearly evening. The day is almost over." So he went in to stay with them. When he was at the table with them, he took bread, gave thanks, broke it, and began to give it to them. Then their eyes were opened and they recognized him, and he disappeared from their sight. Then they asked each other, "Were not our hearts burning within us while he talked to us on the road and opened the scriptures to us?" Burning hearts. It was Albert Einstein who wanted to explain the theory of relativity. So Einstein explained it this way. He said, if you put your hand on a hot stove for a minute, it will seem like an hour. He said, if you sit with a pretty girl and talk to her, it'll seem like 5 minutes. That's the way he explained the theory of relativity. And like I say, we don't know how long Jesus taught, but I bet it flew by, don't you? And Cleopas and his friend do what they do in the East. They offered them hospitality. when we were last in Israel, we went as a family and we hired a car and we decided to potter around, and we all chose one place we wanted to see. And for one of the weekends, we went to visit a church in Nazareth. And as we got into the car park, we were immediately greeted by a family who had two children, almost the same ages as my two. And so the kids naturally stuck to each other and started playing ball games in the car park. And the adults came up and gave us a hug, and we started to chat. And we did the service. And at the end of the service, they said, "Where are you going?" I said, "Well, we're just, no, coming to our house." And we said, no, we, you know, we've only just met you, we've got some plans. No, you've got to come at least have a drink. And it was polite insistence, if you know what I mean. They weren't rude, they weren't nasty, but the more they talk, the more we realise we're not going to escape these folks. They've got us. And they took us back to their house, and we had they got a little stove out, and we sat on the floor. They were Arabs, and out came the coffee pot and the teapot, and we had one drink and we chatted, and then out came the food, and we were there for about 4 or 6 hours. It was just but you know, that was one of the highlights of our trip, just enjoying fellowship with God's people in that situation. And these two say to Jesus, "Where are you going?" And with polite insistence, they say, "No, you come back to our house." That's what we do in our kind, in our country, in our situation. And they invite him back. And as they do, they break bread. And in the breaking of the bread, they recognize Jesus. I love that. In the breaking of the bread, they recognize Jesus. Was it the words he spoke? Was it the way he prayed? Was it when he lifted up his hands, they saw the nail prints? We're not told. But through that special, simple event, they recognise Jesus. We were at a wedding not long ago, and the reception was at the bottom of a hill. And the bride and the groom had gone off to have photographs taken in a sort of countryside by a lake. And everyone else had gone to the reception. So we're at the reception waiting for them to come. And as this Rolls Royce comes down the hill, it was a silver shadow Rolls Royce, came down the hill, parked in front of the hotel. Everyone was outside to greet them. All the men looked at each other and said, "Wow, what a car." And all the ladies looked at each other and said, "Wow, look at the bride." And you kind of think we missed the point, us men, didn't we? Because it wasn't about the car, it's about the bride. And they recognise Jesus in the breaking of bread. And so often we enjoy all the trappings and we miss the main point. And whenever we break bread, whenever we come to church, if we don't meet with Jesus, we've missed out, haven't we? We've missed out. And then finally, boasting hearts. Verse 33, when they got up and returned at once to Jerusalem, there they found the 11 and those with them assembled together. And saying, "It is true. The Lord has risen and has appeared to Simon." Then the two told what happened to them on the way and how Jesus was recognized by them when he broke the bread. Boasting hearts. What else can you do when you encounter Jesus? Surely you've got to share that with someone, haven't you? Can't keep it the world's biggest secret. We have a living Christ. The older I get, the more I realise the uniqueness of the Christian message. There is no message to compare with it. It is what every single person needs. They just don't realise it yet. I was up at the football Wednesday night. I went to see my team lose. And I'm in a minibus full of men. And to listen to their pointless banter. You got guys there who are nice guys. Some of them are family guys. Some of them are hard workers. They're career people. And what are they living for? To watch 11 men every week kick a ball of air around the pitch. Now, I love my football and I follow my team. But if that's all I've got in life, I think I've missed the point. They need to know about Jesus. And it's good when one-to-one they come and ask you and questions. But we've got the greatest message in the world. But it's only good news if we share it. If we share it. They went back and they told others about Jesus. And if nothing else, may that be our challenge this week when we leave this place. Is there someone you can tell about Jesus? So in conclusion, the road to Emmaus is a symbol of the Christian life. This story is about ordinary despair, ordinary heartbreak, ordinary sadness, that Monday morning drudgery that so often we experience in life. This is a story about meeting a stranger, hearing words of comfort, sitting down at a table and eating a meal. This is a story about the meaning of Easter. The historic event or the celebration may now be over, but the fact Christ is alive, Christ is with us, Christ is leading us, carries on and ought to bring hope for today, strength for today, sorry, and hope for the future. It enables us to see the world not as a place of death, decay and defeat, but as a place waiting, groaning toward God's final victory. Let me finish with one final quote. Someone said this, that change took place, and it describes like this. Their lives prior to this moment were like a smouldering fire that gave no light, just smoke to cloud things up. But once they came into the presence of the risen Lord, their hearts were ablaze. A burning fire gives light for all to see, and they saw, understood, and believed, all because of the risen Lord. Victory became their restoring hope. It became the anchor of their lives. Let's pray.